What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Hannah Miller and Kate Clark are both reporters at The Information. Every year, they put together a list of the 50 most promising startups. And this year, they've included a number of crypto companies. In this conversation, we talked through a number of those companies on the 50 most promising startups list, and we also talked through a ton of different lessons learned, along with various storylines that people are covering going into 2022. I really enjoyed this conversation with both Hannah and Kate, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is LMAX Digital, the number one institutional crypto exchange. They offer clients the deepest pool of crypto liquidity on the planet, underscored by a 100% uptime track record through volatility spikes. They leverage LMAX Group's liquidity relationships and ultra-low latency technology. LMAX Digital is the market-leading solution for institutional crypto trading and custodial services. If you've never heard of LMAX Digital, it's probably because you are not an institution. They have no retail, only institutions. They feature a central limit order book streaming spot Bitcoin, Ether, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash, all paired with US dollars, euro, and yen. LMAX Digital. They're secure, they're liquid, and they're trusted. Learn more at lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Again, lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Next up is Compass Mining. Compass Mining is the world's largest marketplace for mining hardware and hosting. With Compass, everyone can mine Bitcoin. Their team makes it easy to start mining wherever you want, at home or in one of their 23 hosting facilities around the world. Through the Compass Marketplace, retail miners can access mining hardware with similar prices and purchase plans as the world's largest mining companies. Compass miners own their machines, they choose whatever mining pool they want, and they mine directly to their own wallets. Miners who don't want to host their machines can order ASICs directly to their doorstep. Simple and low-cost hosting agreements coupled with best-in-class customer service are the reasons why Compass is the simplest and most popular way to mine Bitcoin. Start mining your own Bitcoin today by visiting compassmining.io. Again, compassmining.io. Go check them out and let me know what you think. Last but not least are my friends over at OKX. Crypto is all about democratization and freedom of choice, but many companies limit their offerings to centralized trading products. The crypto companies leading the pack in terms of innovation are those that extend access to the industry's cutting-edge products and services, bridging CeFi and DeFi. If you're searching for a platform that reflects crypto's promise of a more open and less restrictive financial future, look no further than OKX. On OKX now, you can easily switch over to the new DeFi mode. Connect OKX's bespoke Web3 wallet via browser extension and start exploring opportunities at the bleeding edge of crypto. From the DeFi dashboard, you can monitor your portfolio of self-custodied assets across a range of blockchain networks and generate passive income from yield farming with top DeFi protocols. In the NFT marketplace, you can participate in exclusive drops and trade non-fungible tokens without secondary market fees. Meanwhile, the GameFi section is your portal to the latest and greatest in play-to-earn and blockchain gaming. Venture to the forefront of crypto innovation and connect with OKX DeFi today. Again, go check them out at OKX. That's where you can find OKX DeFi. All right, let's get into this episode. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, we have Hannah and Kate from The Information. I believe both of you guys are here. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having us.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. We got a whole bunch of stuff to get into here. I want to start first with help us understand how you guys put together the 50 most promising startups list. And then also maybe if you can separate out the difference between what you're trying to accomplish with the actual list itself, like the just, hey, here's the companies. And then you've got this whole kind of report on like what we took away from it as well, what we learned from it. So there's almost like trends that come out of the work, and then there's a list that you produce. And so how do you guys think about the difference between the two?
Yeah, so last year was the first year that we started this project. And basically, the goal is to identify 50 or so companies that represent the startup ecosystem and that are the best in their categories. So we have the consumer, we have fintech, we have crypto, and this was the first year that we did a crypto section. But yeah, I think we try to talk to the top investors in venture capital and all of the founders and to determine what companies are the most promising. It is difficult because you're looking at early stage and a lot of these companies are sort of still building a product or very early in launching their product, which can make it difficult. But I'll let Hannah talk about the crypto section because she was the genius behind that one.
Yeah, no, it was the first year that we had a dedicated crypto section. So it was really exciting, you know, talking to different people about the companies that they were excited about. And yeah, in putting together a crypto section, I tried, you know, touching on different areas within crypto. So there's, you know, NFTs, DeFi, Web3, someone who actually developed their own cryptocurrency. So I wanted a nice mix to reflect this very diverse, very interesting industry.
So Hannah, maybe I'll ask this one to you, which is when you think about the industry, one of the things that adds complexity is the fact that they're not all companies, right? That there's in the traditional kind of software world, obviously you have a hierarchical structure, centralized kind of entity. People, when you say it's a startup, they know what that means and it encompasses a bunch of different things. Here you have everything from decentralized networks. You have centralized networks pretending to be decentralized. You have DAOs. You have various projects, et cetera. How did you think about like what was kind of inbounds to be included? And was there anything that you said, well, actually, we don't think that that's the type of asset or network or anything like that that we would want to include on a list like this? Like what was kind of the framework you used?
Yeah, I mean, we did have metrics looking at, you know, the amount of funding that they had raised. So, you know, that was that helped with boundaries and also their valuations. So, you know, everyone had to raise under 100 million and be valued at less than a billion. So that was really helpful. I lost companies along the way if they were raising, you know, new funding, things like that. But yeah, it was kind of tricky explaining, you know, that maybe this, you know, this is a decentralized entity that doesn't have a revenue model yet, or they're working on it. When I was, you know, talking with my editors. But yeah, I mean, with this one, I also wanted to make sure that, you know, there were companies and, you know, decentralized entities that people could understand, that readers would actually connect with. So I sort of like stayed away from DAOs this time around, even though there's obviously huge VC interest in DAOs and they're doing really interesting stuff.
Got it. And then in terms of ranking them, how much severity or importance should people place on like who gets number one versus number five versus number 50? Like when you think of the actual rankings themselves, how important is that to kind of look at the actual number?
Yeah, with the rankings, I definitely was sort of taking into different things into account. I mean, I definitely looked at sort of the pedigree of the founders, whether they'd had, you know, past experiences, had they been in crypto before. I did look at, you know, how long they'd been around, what sorts of funding they had raised, and also just, you know, taking into account the future outlook that the founders had in terms of what they saw, in terms of opportunities for, you know, what they were developing and, you know, kind of how they could, whether or not they could actually explain the value proposition of their project in a way that was interesting and believable.
Got it. And then Kate, when we think about some of the lessons that you guys learned from this, in the report, you guys call out a couple of kind of key learnings, I'll call them. One of them is high multiples, which it almost has become like a joke at this point, right? In terms of everyone's like, oh, of course the multiples are high. It's just like, how high can they go? How do you guys think about that as you've been kind of watching this play out over the last couple of years, as you've been reporting on the tech industry? Like, is this something that's just cyclical and eventually kind of comes down? Or is there something that's kind of quote unquote, you know, it's different this time that you think sticks?
I mean, I think there's probably two answers to that. And one is specifically about crypto and one is about the wider industry. But yeah, at this point, we do expect to see, you know, 100 or even 200x multiples or higher. And they are ridiculous and they will come down, but it's something that we've come to expect. So it wouldn't hurt or help a company if we're trying to decide whether it should make the list. When it comes to crypto, I do think those multiples are getting larger, larger, larger. I think that they'll continue to rise through next year. Depends on who you ask, though. Some people are much more skeptical about what's happening with the Web3 movement and the explosion in venture capital interest in crypto, which is incredibly new and historically, you know, wasn't there. So I think that'll last through 2022. But I'm sure Hannah saw that a lot when she was trying to put her list together. I focused on fintech, and that has been a sector that for the last several years has been really exploding, and the multiples and the valuations have been growing. And I think we're starting to see maybe some of that excitement diminish a little bit as VCs sort of shift over to crypto, though there is an intersection between crypto and fintech, you know, more exclusively crypto companies.
Makes sense. And then in terms of the list and the learnings, I actually thought that one of the most interesting sections was also the venture capitalists that showed up the most. And I think that we usually think about the companies and kind of what they're building, what their product, what their valuations, their revenue, et cetera. But Kate, there's a whole section on everyone from Andreessen to Y Combinator to Founders Fund. Then even in China, you guys break down kind of some of the big investors there. Was there anything that was surprising about this, or is it kind of the storylines that people know that, you know, the Tigers of the world, the Andreessens, they're just deploying, you know, an immense amount of money. And so, of course, they're going to be in a ton of deals.
I don't think there was anything surprising about it. I think that one of the themes we've written about this year is that Andreessen and Tiger, you know, are dominating venture capital. They've probably each done maybe close to 200 deals and hundreds of deals this year. Tiger, I think, actually is probably near 400. So like essentially one deal per day, which we've not seen that before. And they've kind of, as we've said, they've sort of changed and disrupted the venture capital industry by being so active in their deal making this year. So when we were putting the list together, I think we really expected to see them show up a lot. And of course, I mean, Andreessen has proven that they have the strategy of sort of outpacing their competitors. And I mean, especially in crypto, as you all know, they were much earlier to the category in raising their first crypto fund in 2018 and have doubled down on it far ahead of competitors who are just kind of realizing in the last, say, 6 months that this is a category that they need to understand and invest in.
Talk to me about Tiger. They've got almost $100 billion of assets under management. What is like your general take in terms of their strategy? What do you hear other people talking about? Do people like them, not like them? Do people think that they are kind of, you know, smart investors? Do they think that they're just kind of spreading capital? Like, what are you hearing?
So Tiger is a really small team. And like I said, they've done basically one deal a day. And these are not small investments. These are very big, typically growth stage investments, though they are kind of going at all stages, which is interesting. I think that people think they are smart. They have a very specific strategy, which is to invest the capital and then walk away from the company, basically. Meaning, you know, they will give you your $200 million check, and maybe they'll check in with you once a quarter or maybe a little more often than that and just be like, how's it going? They also provide their companies access to consulting firms who will help them out versus a traditional firm would probably themselves offer that resource. They're very hands-off. And I think people respect that they are just going to be incredibly accelerated in their investing pace and yet know that they can't be involved with all their companies. I think if they tried to be as helpful as a traditional firm like an Andreessen Horowitz, which is more of a model that is hands-on, they would not be successful. But the fact that they're willing to just walk away from each deal and just be like, yeah, that's who we are, we're not going to be hands-on, I think people respect that.
Yeah. And it also feels, I think probably the number one thing I've heard from founders is just when they show up to the meeting, they're the most prepared investors, which I think people really respect, right? It's kind of a thing where if you take your craft seriously and you've done the pre-work and you show up, people put a very, very high premium on that. And so they're willing to kind of conform to whatever your working relationship ideally is. If they say, hey, look, you really know what you're doing. You move with speed and conviction. You write a big check. So I think it makes sense.
They don't waste time.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if you ask founders, I think that's probably one of the biggest things. It's like, hey, I want an investor that doesn't waste my time. So and maybe in some weird way, they've actually figured out the most important things and they're focused on that and they're ignoring the other stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that founders, like you said, I think founders really appreciate that. And they will walk into a meeting with a term sheet. They're ready. They already have everything established. And they're just like, we're ready to invest. You know, we're well, wire you the money tomorrow. And I think that has also forced other firms to behave more similarly and to also accelerate their investment processes. You know, an investment historically could take months to really come to a close, including diligence, which is an important step. I think we're seeing that rushed in this current market. But yeah, other firms have watched how Tigers behaved and they're adapting to it. I think Andreessen, I think Sequoia, a lot of these top firms are watching these hedge funds that have crossed over into venture and they're taking notes and they're changing their styles up a little bit.
For sure. John, what questions you got?
Yeah, I guess this might be for Hannah or whichever one, but we're investors in QuickNote and I see that's on the list. Can you explain how a company like that gets on the list?
Yeah, no, I mean, they provide a valuable service in terms of helping their partners actually use and understand blockchain technology. And I think the fact that they're able to sort of do the dirty hard work in terms of, you know, setting, helping people set up, helping them build apps, helping them deal with things like, you know, figuring out how to use a node, stuff along those lines, they're doing a valuable service. They've also just seen huge boosts in revenue. They have a pretty solid revenue model, and they're already working with big clients. So to me, those factors made them perfect for the list.
And so Hannah, when you see something like that, like how important is revenue for, you know, QuickNode's one example, but there's a ton on here. When I was looking through the list, I saw some that literally have no revenue, some that have very, very impressive revenue. And so like, how did you think about the importance of revenue, given that some of these companies are very, very early stage and still somewhat speculative?
Yeah, I mean, Audius, for example, doesn't have any revenue, but in that case, I thought this was, you know, this was an entity really approaching Web3 in a really smart way. And it's also, you know, taking on the music industry. And to me, that was really, really fascinating. So I think, you know, I tried sort of adapting my view, depending on, you know, which company I was talking to, whether, you know, they were earning revenue or not, and sort of thinking, you know, kind of future outlook. And to me, Audius seems like they could be a big player in Web3, even though there's not really a revenue model. They're working on it. But at the end of the day, most of the money spent on that platform is going to go to the artists.
Got it. John, you don't know this. Two of the top six companies on the crypto top 50 list were investors in. That's pretty good.
Good list.
Great list. Yeah. Kate, we talked last year and we did a whole big deep dive on fintech and kind of everything that was happening there. It feels like, and you mentioned a little bit earlier as well, that some of the fintech investors now are kind of fancying themselves crypto investors. It just feels like maybe the lines are blurring. And so like, how do you think about it from like a coverage standpoint? Are crypto companies fintechs or fintechs crypto companies? Does it matter? Like just what do you think there?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think a year ago, I would have said, you know, they're 100% different categories. There's not much of an intersection there. And slowly that's changing. I think what you'll see is the existing fintechs, and you've seen, you know, companies like Robinhood and others already do this, but start to really embrace crypto, whatever that means for their business model. Lately in the conversations I've had with fintech CEOs, I've asked like, how does crypto fit into your roadmap? And there's definitely a mixture of people who are kind of in denial about needing to incorporate that into their roadmap and others who are really excited about it, kind of just depending on how excited, you know, they are as people about the Web3 movement and everything that's happening. But I mean, I think, you know, down the line, those will be under one umbrella, but they're still separate because a lot of these companies that are really big fintech companies just have nothing in their business having to do with, you know, currencies or blockchain technology at all. So until that changes, they will probably be treated as different categories. But like I said before, I do think you're going to see a lot of investors in fintech totally shift away from that toward crypto next year and look only for fintechs that are also somehow Web3 companies or considered Web3 companies.
Yeah. And one of the things I guess as part of that conversation is we've seen MicroStrategy, Tesla, Square all put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Are we watching or seeing any of these startups do the same thing? Like the crypto native ones, I think it's just inherently with their business model, they have it. But in the fintech specifically, we've had one of the co-founders of Ramp come on and they didn't buy Bitcoin for the balance sheet. They put some of the balance sheet in stable coins to try to earn a little bit more yield. What are you seeing there with these kind of like more traditional fintech firms and what they're doing with their balance sheets?
Yeah, that's a good example. I think I've asked Ramp kind of similarly about incorporating crypto into their company's future. I think it's early. So the Web3, the general mainstream interest in Web3, as you know, is very recent. I think, you know, that's something that happened in pretty much like the last quarter of this year. So I think next year, one of the big stories that I will, I'm sure, write about in several different ways is going to be the massive pivot, whether branding or more serious, but pivot toward Web3 in all categories. I mean, you're going to see creator economy, consumer art, fintech, Enterprise, surely all these companies are going to try to do that. So I think it is early. Currently, I probably wouldn't have a lot of examples of companies I know are doing it. Definitely talk to some early stage companies that have said, like, we are repositioning toward Web3 or we're rebranding, like, in that way. But I think we're going to see sort of a hilarious amount of that in the first few months and going into the rest of next year. And it'll be something that people will probably make fun of, but will certainly be happening.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And it also feels like there's a bunch of folks who didn't know anything about this 2 years ago. Now we're getting up to speed. And so once you understand it, then you start to act. Hannah, what are you seeing with NFTs and a lot of these projects or companies? That obviously, I think, was like one of the big stories of 2021. Are they doing anything there? Is that changing business models? Or is it basically you're an NFT company, you do that? If you're not an NFT company, you may be aware of it, but you're not actually doing anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously NFTs are really exciting and you're seeing more non-crypto companies getting interested in them. And that's also why I put Mojito on the list. They're sort of this guide for getting companies in all industries interested in NFTs. And, you know, Sotheby's is one of their big clients. They've done $100 million in NFT sales this year. So I think the NFT world is open to anyone, but companies that don't necessarily have a presence there to start with in crypto need someone to help guide them and help them build a tailored marketplace. And I'm really excited also about NFTs and gaming. I think there's huge possibilities there, especially as more conversations start happening about the metaverse.
John, what other questions you got?
Yeah, Hannah and Kate, can you guys talk about what you see the most opportunity and like what's the coolest part about crypto? And then what's the dumbest thing to you about crypto?
I can start. I mean, I'll start with the dumbest. I think it's not necessarily about crypto, but I think the dumbest thing about it right now is sort of the fake embracing of it. You see a lot of people doing, like you said before, a couple of years ago, people weren't paying attention. And like just the Twitter behavior around it, like all of these people sort of making their Twitter avatars Bored Apes and all of these things. It's like, I don't know. I feel like we're going to look back and it will be sort of this strange moment where everybody felt that they had to kind of pretend like they were crypto people, kind of even before they really understand the technology. So a little bit, I guess, of just like the parading around on social media around crypto is the thing that I find to be sort of the dumbest. I'm really excited to personally learn more about DeFi and to go into next year and try to better cover that industry. Because I think that there's a lot of coverage around NFTs and there's a lot of coverage around kind of just Web3 broadly. And even around DAOs, there's coverage and a lot of conversation. But I think that because DeFi is sort of inherently less sexy in that it's more infrastructure and behind the scenes, there's been a lot less conversation around it. So I think that's probably the sector that I'm most interested in covering and excited about.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's so much to be excited about in crypto. And yeah, I mean, definitely, I'm excited with NFTs, as I said, gaming. DeFi, I am sort of interested in seeing how that evolves. It's not an easy area for people to get into. So I'm sort of looking at how, DeFi protocols are tackling that problem. And yeah, obviously there's the specter of regulation. You know, what are we going to see here? I think it's going to be a big year for compliance startups that can help, different companies enter crypto and already have things like KYC and AML, as things that they don't have to worry about. I think also, Kate kind of touched on this, but yeah, some of the silliest things about crypto, it's a little cringeworthy at times, just seeing on Twitter, like how people try to tweet and change the language and their profiles, to make it seem like they're cool and with it when they're really just hopping on board. So that can be a little silly sometimes to look at. And also there's just some silly stuff with NFTs, of course, I think I saw today that the first ever like text message sent on a Vodafone is like going up for auction as an NFT. So, but it's also fun to see those things too.
I am convinced, and I don't remember Hannah or Kate, which one of you said it, but this whole idea of like changing the profile picture to not your face, doesn't make sense unless you're completely pseudonymous. So there's, I think it's like Punk6529, right? Where that is the entire point of the identity is that it is a pseudonymous person. It's known by that identity and it's talking about that, et cetera. That makes a ton of sense then. But I think that there's something around like social media is a brand. And so like people recognize your profile picture as much as they recognize your name. And like that when they're seeing you, especially as you build a bigger audience. And so the ability to tell the difference between the apes or the punks or whatever is actually like much harder than I think people realize. And so if you use your real name, but you use like basically a pseudonymous photo, I think that people don't understand like the long-term implications of that. And like that actually may be detrimental to the kind of use of social media, except for to the maybe like a brand building or like community building within that community. So if you have a, obviously an ape, like you basically build, you know, kind of positively with other people in that community, but outside everyone's like, hey man, like who are you?
If you want to build a long-term brand with your NFT, if it's an ape or a CryptoPunk or whatever it is, it's a long-term commitment. And so sure, if you keep it for years, you can develop a brand. And I know a lot of people are really excited about the ability to kind of create a brand out of their metaverse avatar. But most of these people probably will be changing their pictures back to their normal photos or other NFTs and things like that. In which case, you know, I think it's more of just an experiment, which is completely fine and great. And I think it's really fascinating to see. I just think at times it's also like a really silly way of trying to show that you're hip with the new internet trends or hip with the crypto jargon. That is probably not as effective as those people think when it comes to actually impressing those people who are more crypto native. I'm guessing they probably can identify the people who are just kind of, like Hannah said, hopping up onto the bandwagon in 2021.
I don't know which one of you guys want to answer this, but is it fair to say that the startup community looks at the moves by like a Facebook becoming Meta and doing all of that? Are they hopping on the bandwagon as well? Or is this something that's much more kind of like organic to a big company like that? Like, what do you hear from founders and some of these startups?
Yeah, well, the founder of The Sandbox the other day really came down on Meta. And said that his main mission right now is to defend against these big, you know, big tech giants coming into the metaverse. And he just doesn't think that it's possible for them to really make a difference in this space that will benefit users, that they're too beholden to their shareholders. So, you know, I think it'll be really interesting to see sort of that clash down the line. So, yeah, I would say there are rumblings among founders. You know, there is sort of this, you know, sort of, I guess, shaking their heads about this. And it's interesting also to see too, like, you know, Solana Labs, like they told me a few weeks ago that they've talked to literally every social media platform, you know, that big tech giants are interested in this space and they're coming in.
Can I share a hot take I have that I'd love to get your guys' reaction from? I think that startup founders are amazing. The one thing that I think they get completely misplaced on is they all are the exact same as Facebook. They're all the same as Microsoft. They're all the same as IBM because there's this like weird balance. If you live long enough, if you survive long enough, you go from the challenger or like the pirate to the man. Like there was a point where Bill Gates was the challenger. He was in the, you know, garage and he was trying to take down the incumbents. Mark Zuckerberg, same thing. And like you go through the whole thing. And so it's like in some weird way, everyone always believes like, oh, I won't become the man. But if you're successful enough, like you absolutely will. Right. And I think that that gets lost because it's easy to point and say like, oh, the current incumbent, they're bad for XYZ reason. And they may actually be. But I wonder how much of it is can a new crop of founders or companies actually change kind of the historical trends or, you know, hey, this is the way that it works. And like, you just eventually become old and, you know, kind of have a rigid mind and, you know, you suffer at the fate of success.
Yeah. I think in this market too, it's interesting because some of these companies are becoming incumbents from challengers at an accelerated rate. Like we talked about Ramp. That's a company that's like maybe 2 years old. That's worth many, many billions of dollars. And even like Sam at FTX, you know, that company's worth like over $30 billion and is very, very young. And these companies will probably also go public or other things sooner than they would have, you know, years ago when we would complain, or even last year, we complain about the fact that unicorns stay private for 10, 12 years, like the kind of Uber or Pinterest cohort. And I that's got to change. I have to imagine seeing the way that these valuations are skyrocketing, unless we're just going to start having like $200 billion private companies, which is not healthy for the market. I think you'll start to see that. So it'll be interesting to see how those founders cope with that, because that is a really probably intensive and stressful position to be in, like seeing your company go from like zero to 100 in 12 months.
For sure. Hannah, maybe the last question I'll ask is one idea that I think we've seen for years now is unicorn status was this thing that everyone aspired to in the traditional kind of startup equity world. It seems like now you can literally start a company and be a billion-dollar business with like an idea. Today, I don't want to say the name of the company, but there's a company that raised at a $1.5 billion valuation. They have less than $1 million of revenue. It's a third raise they've done this year. Like, I mean, it's just getting crazy. And so one is just like the unicorn status, I think now has been watered down. And so there's people who've been ahead of this. Keith Raboy and many others have said, hey, it's not about building a $1 billion company. It's about building a $10 billion company. And I think that that was pretty prescient for them to kind of notice that. When we look at crypto, the equity companies seem to still follow the exact same kind of trajectory as traditional equity, just in a different industry. But these networks and these tokens, et cetera, like how do you think about the valuations of those compared to equity? And one of the things that, you know, I frankly don't have an opinion on yet, but I find fascinating is it seems like when a lot of these folks are launching, they're $500 million, $1 billion of fully diluted value almost immediately. And like, is that a replacement for the equity valuation? Or should we think about that as something different and like it's unfair to be like, oh, you built a unicorn because your fully diluted value of a coin that you kind of created out of thin air is now $1 billion?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of these, you know, companies, especially when it comes to token investments, investors aren't as much thinking about them as like, oh, I can make a huge profit off of this. It's I want to be a huge part of something that could change the world down the line. You know, that this is going to be a huge staple within Web3, and that this is something that I want to be a part of. So I do think there's a little bit of a different mindset sometimes with, you know, investors looking at, you know, a protocol that isn't necessarily about making money. It's about actually decentralizing things. That's a major shift in my opinion. You know, I think down the line, just token investments, that's going to be, you know, a common thing. I mean, I have seen some still do equity. For example, Mysten Labs, which is all ex-Novi people, they did an equity investment from the start, even though they are building a blockchain that they could have done tokens with. So there are some interesting, you know, I guess, holdouts in that sense. But I do think that we're seeing a new trend that's going to stick with crypto and maybe even extend into other areas as we look more at decentralized technologies.
Makes sense. Before I let you guys go, what are your guys' Twitter accounts? People are saying if they want to follow you online, where should we send them?
Mine's Kate Clark Tweets.
And I'm HG Miller 29.
All right. And then Kate, I'll give you the floor only because we did it last year. What's the pitch for people to go subscribe to the information?
I mean, the information has the most in-depth articles covering Silicon Valley, Wall Street, Hollywood, and beyond. I think if you're looking for really high quality journalism that helps you understand the most important people and companies in those areas, we're absolutely the best place to go.
That's a pretty solid pitch.
That was great.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like you've done that before. All right. Awesome. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to do this. The list is amazing every single year. So hopefully we'll do it again next year. And as John said, we like the list even more when our companies are on there. So hopefully we'll send you some of those.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys. Talk soon. Thanks.